Welcome to the Retail Focus Podcast, a weekly collection of news, interviews, and information from the world of retail. Here are your hosts, Trent Kling and Leighton Kling.
Hello and welcome to the Retail Focus Podcast. I'm Trent Kling. Well, both Leighton and I this week are in areas that make it difficult to record from. We opted outside, so to speak, for July 4th, and as a result, this is a best of episode. We have thousands of listeners each week, but not everyone was listening right at the beginning when we had some of our most impactful interviews. So today we're going to revisit our chats with three retail visionaries about their developments in the retail landscape. And although it's been a few years since we've talked to each of them, their words still ring very much true. And the interviews, I believe, will reveal some interesting tidbits to our listeners. A reminder, please like us and rate us wherever you do listen, whether that be iTunes or someplace else. You can also visit us on Twitter and Instagram at Retail Podcast. To start this week's show, the shopping cart, it's nearly ubiquitous in retail today. Nearly every retail store of a certain size has their own iteration of the shopping cart, and the cart's still used as the icon of choice for most e-commerce sites. But developing a cart from an engineering perspective isn't easy, especially when you're an outsider attempting to do what had never before been done. And that's exactly what Drew Ann Long set out to do. Long is the creator of Caroline's Cart, and we spoke to her back in October of 2016 about the process behind bringing the first ever cart intended for the special needs population to retail stores throughout the country. We're joined this week by Drew Ann Long, who is the founder of Caroline's Cart and also the creator of Caroline's Cart. Drew Ann, welcome to the Retail Focus Podcast.
Thank you so much. Glad to be here.
First, we'll begin with kind of the basics. For those that maybe aren't familiar with Caroline's Cart, what is it?
It is the first ever patented special needs shopping cart for the older child / adult up to 250 pounds.
So when you began the development of it, or when this idea was spurred on, what kind of created this idea, this concept in your head? What is the backstory as far as the creation of Caroline's Cart?
Okay, I have three children, and my middle child, Caroline, is special needs, does not walk or talk. She has never walked. So early on in her life, when I had to go to the grocery store, which I do 3-4 times a week, I could fit her into the standard cart. Y'all know what that is. You know, the basket right there for the little toddler. When she outgrew that, I moved on to the fun carts, or the amusement carts is what they're called in the industry. The car carts, the truck carts. You've probably seen them where the toddler or the preschooler can sit and they can pretend like you're driving and a basket is attached. Most stores have those. So, you know, until about 7 years old, I could find something that the retailer provided for her to use. Well, when she outgrew that, I thought, well, you know, there's carts for just about every people group out there. Certainly there is a special needs grocery cart out there. I just live in small town Alabama and it's just not here yet. So I went home, started doing a little research, started talking to different store managers, and found out that there never has been a special needs shopping cart. And I was very puzzled and surprised because, you know, I thought this industry is so accommodating to customers. Some grocery stores have actually like a babysitting service where you can drop your child off at the front of the store. There's electric scooters, there's toddler carts, there's preschool carts, there's infant carts. And I thought that there was a real gap in the market. So the idea for Caroline's Cart literally was birthed out of a need for my own child.
I think a lot of people, when they see developments like this, they assume that it was, hey, came up with an idea, and then a month later, these carts were churning out on the production line. But we were talking before we came to air, the process is actually much longer than that. What was the timeline like from the point where you had this idea, you noticed this need, to the testing and then eventual adoption of the cart by retailers?
I actually started working on this. My husband and I talked about it for a good year. And the more I talked about it, really the more frustrated and angry I got that no one had ever addressed this problem before. So I told my husband, I said, you know, in 2008, you know, it was January, I said, I'm doing it. We're doing it. We had prayed about it. We are very strong in our faith. And I felt like this was the Lord's calling on my life. And I thought, okay, well, then this won't be hard. So I sketched it down on a napkin and I thought, okay, it's not a rocket ship. This certainly can't be hard. And I did not, from January 2008, the first carts shipped October 9th, 2012. And, you know, it just took that long for me to figure out how to do this, how to navigate this industry. And at first, you know, I had gone to a very large manufacturer with my idea, and they had told me no at the time. And funny story, I work with them now, but at the time they say, you know, it's a great idea, but we cannot do this. So I was back to the drawing board, looked just again, just I did not have a clue how to do this. So I had to work with a smaller manufacturer just to seed the market with 100 carts. But I had heard time and time again that most retailers only buy from one manufacturer, and that is Technibuilt. They're located in North Carolina. So it was a lot of just walking in the dark, lots of failures, just trying to figure out, you know, how to do this. Finally, I did find a way, and I got my first prototype, and it grew from there. But it was a very daunting and just a kind of a scary process for that first 4 years for sure.
That's an excellent story as far as the creation of it. I want to switch gears now and talk a little bit about Caroline's Cart and its adoption in retail stores. From your perspective, not only as, of course, the business owner and the founder of Caroline's Cart, but also as someone with experience with special needs children, why is it important for retailers to offer the cart to their customers?
Because stores are not accessible. And again, what drove me the many times, millions of times I wanted to quit was the fact that retailers provided a different variety of carts. If the electric scooter did not exist, if the fun carts, toddler carts, and infant carts didn't exist, probably I never would have started this. But because retailers provide a variety of carts for a variety of people group, you cannot leave out the special needs community. And that's what kept me going. And again, I think I said this earlier, the retailer, it's a very customer-accommodating industry. They want you in. They draw you in. It's a competitive business. And the same goes with their cart. And what was very difficult for me to get Caroline's Cart off the ground was creating the demand for it. When you do something that's never been done, you have to prove that the need is there. It wasn't hard to do with the special needs families. I mean, one in five between 6 and 18 have a disability. So they jumped on the bandwagon immediately. The challenge was convincing the retailer that, hey, your store's not accessible. There's a need. You have all these other carts. You need to add another one for the special needs children and adults in your community.
When you look at the feedback on social media regarding Caroline's Cart, it's been almost unanimously positive. From your perspective, what's some of the feedback the retailers have gotten once they begin to offer Caroline's Cart to their customers?
Oh, it's been tremendous. We have had thousands of articles, news stories done in all these communities. The media loves Caroline's Cart because it's different, it's unique, it fills a need, and it's a feel-good story. So, you know, for a store to come out and say, hey, our store is now accessible, it's just been tremendous. It's great for that store because they get so much positive media from it. So much positive media. I mean, just the Target alone. Target launched their nationwide announcement February of 2015. Even again today, new stores are still coming in based on that. So it's a win-win. That's what I've always said. It's a win-win. It's a win-win for the family. It's a win-win for the retailer.
So looking at the nationwide spread or the further spread of Caroline's Cart, where can people find Caroline's Cart now? What retailers have those? It's obviously nationwide for Target, but is it somewhat limited at this point by region, or which retailers are adopting this?
We're in every single state, and we're in four countries. Excited about that. You can go on our website, and there's a map of the U.S. You just click on the state, and we have a listing by city. We are in, you know, every Wegmans. Target is not the only retailer that put it nationwide. It was the largest, for sure, and the most well-known. But every Wegmans has Caroline's Cart. Every ShopRite has Caroline's Cart on the East Coast. You know, there's so many more. I don't have the list in front of me, but the growth has been tremendous. Every year, we do better than the year before. Really, every month, we do better than the month before. Because I think it's something that retailers realize once they see it. You know, a lot of people didn't want to be the first, but I think they see the positive response. And they understand that that's a need that they want to meet. So more than likely, if we're not in your local grocery store, you know, go find a Target. We've recently gotten in Walmart, which we're very excited about that. You know, Walmart has approved Caroline's Cart at the corporate level. So if you do not have it at your Walmart, and we are now in hundreds of Walmart, the store manager can order it for you.
Well, that's excellent news for a lot of customers out there. I want to look ahead now. And generally, outside the basic requirements set forth, of course, by the ADA, what else or what are some other things that retailers can do in order to make their stores more accessible to all of their customers?
Well, because of the ADA back in 1991, stores are, they have to, by law, have handicap parking, have the curb that dip down, have the store that, have the doors that open, and have handicap bathrooms. You know, that is something that they all have to have by law. So because they are already meeting those requirements, Carolyn's Cart just makes perfect sense to come in and say, hey, we're accessible by law under all these areas. Now we have added Carolyn's Cart to that. So it really was, it just made sense for retailers just to follow in line with that.
Looking forward, where do you see developments headed in terms of accessibility technology in retail? What are some other areas beyond maybe just the shopping cart where you feel like developments either need to happen or may happen soon?
I think the next thing that makes perfect sense is an accessible changing area. That's very big on social media right now. I don't know if you've seen anything, but Caroline, for example, when I'm out in public, she's 16 years old. She wears a diaper. She is not potty trained. So when I'm out shopping and I have to change her, I have to lay her on the floor in the family bathroom. Family bathrooms was a great step for those with disabilities to have more privacy, to have a larger area, but we still have to lay our children and our adults on the floor. It's really a huge problem. I mean, can you imagine if you had to go into a public bathroom and lay on the floor? You know, no one wants to do that. So I am seeing a lot on social media where we're trying to encourage stores to simply put a table in there, have a changing area. I mean, it could be an army cot. It doesn't have to be expensive. It doesn't have to be something that a store could say, you know what, we just can't do that. But I really would like to see a movement and a change for more accessible bathrooms across the country with the changing table.
Well, that's a great point and something that probably a lot of retailers don't necessarily think about on the onset. I want to move back to you and Caroline's Cart right now. Looking at the future, not only for Caroline's Cart, but for you, what are some projects that you've got in the works and where do you see things headed?
Well, of course, I will, you know, keep being an advocate for Caroline's Cart until all stores are accessible. We would like to, you know, the hashtag we use when we're out there on social media is new standard, hashtag new standard. Because that's what we want. You know, we want all stores to have an accessible cart. So I'm going to keep on, you know, advocating every day for that. I also have a book coming out. Lord willing, the book will be available for sale on December 1st. I hope to begin a public speaking tour. I've done a little bit now, but I think with the book, I'm really going to try to work that a little bit harder and get out there and travel and continue to demand, continue to get the word out for accessible shopping.
That's fantastic. We'll look forward to the release of that book. Drew Ann Long, founder of Caroline's Cart, thank you so much for joining us today.
Great, thank you.
Now in 2018, if you've been anywhere near a grocery store or a Target store, you've probably seen Drew Ann's creation at work. Now TechnaBuilt has released a set of accessories, including a cart seat cushion and headrest for Caroline's Cart. Drew Ann Long's new book, Game Changer, is available in bookstores and on Amazon now. As Drew Ann's story illustrates, not all pathways to entrepreneurship are the same. And for Dave Munson of Saddleback Leather, his story began on a trip to Mexico. He shared his empowering story about the creation of his business and his unique approach to e-commerce culture with us in July of 2017. Dave Munson, thank you so much for joining us today on the Retail Focus podcast.
Oh, well, thanks for having me. I think it'll be a good time.
First, to kind of begin, gave listeners a little bit of a rundown of what Saddleback is, how Saddleback started. But other than simply just needing a bag for your own purposes or for your own studies to carry things around in, what was kind of the driving force behind creating this company and eventually selling and scaling up the sales of these leather products?
Yeah, so I was working with youth. I've always worked, been a youth worker, at-risk youth, and not at-risk youth, but everybody didn't differentiate. But anyway, I was working with a group called Young Life, and we were trying to get it going in Mexico. And it was in 50 other countries, but not in Mexico. And so I was living in Juarez also, you know, while I was selling my bags, trying to get that going, working with youth. And I thought, hey, I wouldn't have to raise support if I could sell these bags. And so I started selling more and more bags to try to, so that I could work with youth without raising support. And, you know, I had so much interest from these bags and from people on eBay. I couldn't keep up. And so I had to stop doing youth work because I was so busy shipping bags and doing customer service and photographing them and all that sort of thing. So then we just started supporting other youth workers to kind of take my place. And so instead of me sitting around a campfire with 30 kids, you know, we'd have three or four sitting around a campfire with 30 kids. And I thought, hey, this is kind of cool. It's like multiplying. So yeah, that was the driving force. That's the reason that I wanted to get it going, is to be able to reach out to more people.
And that's an interesting story, because we hear from so many e-commerce retailers where they look and see a need in the marketplace. They go through all these rounds of venture capital funding. And it seems like authentically your story or your company's story differs a lot from who we talk to and what we see elsewhere in the e-commerce marketplace.
Yeah, you know, I found that there are a lot of people who are generous with their money, with their finances. You know, they give 10 or 20%, you know, of their money. And then there are those who go, I'm going to give as much as I possibly stinking can because my life's short. And, you know, neither one is wrong. It's just what they have on their heart to do. But what happens is when people pick up this whole, like, they go, hey, I get this guy. This guy's kind of like me. Like, I like what he's about. I want to support what they're about. And the why, if y'all haven't seen the Simon Sinek TED Talk on what's your why, what are you about, it's really important. But our why is to reach and help people, and people pick up on that, and they want to get behind that. They don't want to get behind, yeah, I asked Daddy for a business when I graduated from Yale, I said, Daddy, I need a business, Daddy. And Daddy bought me a business, you know. That's not that interesting to get behind, and now you're going to be a millionaire and, you know, all that stuff. So, yeah, people seem to get behind companies that have a good purpose, a good reason for existing.
You mentioned kind of your identification as just a regular guy, and I think that's borne out in a lot of different areas on the website, and I kind of wanted to focus on that for a moment. You guys do all kinds of blog posts, all kinds of videos. And again, you and your family reflected in a lot of the materials on the website. What's kind of the angle you take as far as not necessarily marketing your business, but as far as the approach and how your business appears online?
Yeah, you know what? People want to buy from a person. They don't want to buy from Saddleback Leather Corp. They want to buy from Dave and Suzette. And so the more real we are, the more out there and authentic we are, which, you know, is mainly through video and a lot of writing, people say, hey, I kind of trust this guy. I like him. They're like my neighbor. And so when I meet people in airports and stuff, they go, hey, are you Dave from Saddleback? And I go, yeah. They go, man, I feel like I know you. So it's building that trust. And we do that through, you know, you can't meet everybody and spend time with them, smoke cigars with them, but you can do videos. And so we have a little show called the Not Dead Yet Show that we do. We have, I think, 53 or so episodes so far. And just behind the scenes, the family, you know, and what we do and the business and designing stuff. And we just put it out there and people seem to really like it. I tell people that if you're kind of a jerk, like if you're really not a likable person, don't get on video, because people will pick it up and then you'll lose sales. So they'll pick up what you're about pretty quickly if you put yourself out there on video. And either if you're a trustworthy person, they'll pick that up. Or if you're not very trustworthy, if you wouldn't do business with you, then you probably shouldn't put yourself out there.
Now, you talk about the videos, the blogs, oftentimes the content in these videos and blogs, not only in terms of the construction of the materials at Saddleback, what you guys make, what you guys produce, but also a lot about your life experiences, particularly the blog. How have all of these life experiences that you've had traveling the globe, how have these things shaped your approach to not only e-commerce, but also running the business and your managerial style as a whole?
Well, you know, the more that we get out there, I was sitting by this guy in this airplane one time, and he was from Nepal. And I said, did you have electricity in your house? After we got talking for a little while, did you have electricity growing up? And he looked at me like, what? He goes, big old eyeballs, no. And I said, did you have running water? And he goes, no. How did you know that? because nobody knows that. And I said, yeah, I didn't think you did. I just had a feeling because we've traveled around and we've been places and you see that a lot of the world doesn't have running water in their homes. And so you start seeing people and you start hearing stories and you start seeing people hurting and in need. And you go, wow, there sure is a whole lot more to life than this, than just making myself fat and happy. So then that starts shaping the way we do business. And so like we take our employees and their families. We've taken a lot of them. We haven't done it recently. We're going to get back into it again. We've taken them to Rwanda because we support. We're very involved in a ministry there called Africa New Life. It's like Compassion International. And we support them through our sales. We have several kids of our own over there now. And so we go over and visit and spend time. And the employees go, wow, this is what I'm doing here. This is what my job's all about, is this. And now they go back. You know, we don't have to search real hard for people. We have a lot of really high-level people, really skilled and talented, who come and go, can I work for you? And those guys can choose a lot of places, and they come and ask us if they can work for us because they say, you guys are about what I'm about. I'm done with this success. I want significance. And so, yeah, that shapes our business big time, is what we're about. And traveling, you pick that up.
You mentioned how it's impacted, you know, more or less recruiting or getting good employees to serve in your organization. And I don't want to get into specifics as far as retention rates and all of that stuff, but in terms of organizational culture, how is Saddleback different from maybe other businesses that you've visited or been around or even worked at yourself?
Well, up until a year and a half ago or so, everybody worked from home. And maybe 2 years ago, everybody worked from home. And we began changing that these last couple of years. We're moving mostly everyone to Fort Worth, Texas. But it's the company, it's being able to pour into people, being able to care about people. And it's really hard from a distance. And so we found that working remotely, I only called certain people when something was wrong. And they're like, oh, crap, Dave's calling. And so, but we're very relaxed. You can have all the time off you want as long as your job gets done. People do work from home sometimes. It's not a big deal. People take trips. Not a big deal. As long as not everyone's waiting for you. We're very relaxed, and yet we're turning more and more firm. But just a very relaxed, easygoing culture. Here's something else. I tell people, hey, listen, I hope that one day you quit because your business got going that I helped you with. If you want help, I'll help you. And that you're just too busy to work here anymore. And that kind of takes this relief off, like, okay, I can tell Dave now that I have this little business rather than keeping it secret. You know, I had lunch with Zig Ziglar one time, and he said, try to help everyone around you to be as successful as they can, and then you'll have everything you ever wanted or dreamed of. And so I took that, and I was like, I've been doing that. Like, we've had several businesses. People start their own businesses and have to quit because they were too successful. That's a big difference from, I think, a lot of businesses.
Certainly is unique organizationally to support employees and other endeavors. Again, we're talking to Dave Munson, the CEO and founder of Saddleback Leather Company. And I want to go kind of back to the beginning again. You talked about how when you were starting up, you were selling these bags on eBay. Eventually, you had to abandon other exploits more or less to focus a little bit more on the business and focus on the business's direction. As you got your own website, what were some of the difficulties that your company had in terms of scaling up? That's something that we reference quite a bit, is companies that maybe have trouble or stumbling blocks as they begin to scale up and just sell more product.
Yeah, the difficult part for us was the production. And so nobody loves your stuff as much as you do. You know, I was looking at different places to have them made, Dominican Republic. We were already making them in Mexico, but I couldn't trust the guy who was making them, and we couldn't get the quality we wanted. He didn't really care. And actually, one time I walked down there, and I was like, I went over to one of the sewing machines, and I said, hey, they're using nylon thread on these things, on my bags. They're supposed to be using polyester. I've been paying for polyester. And he goes, the owner was with me, and he goes, oh, no, I am so sorry. Hey, Pedro, you shouldn't do that. You know, I can't believe you did that. So they switched it right in front of me. And anyway, I left. I came back. I flew in just spur of the moment, unannounced, 2 days later, walked past security guard, walked past Carl, walked past everyone, went over to the sewing machine, nylon thread again.
I was like, oh, you dog. You're you dog. And so having stuff made in other places that aren't your own, they'll substitute materials. If you're doing a product-based business, it's the quality, quality, quality. And unless you do it yourself, you really have to trust your manufacturer. So that's been a real big deal with supply. And so we just started our own, and we maintain that good, high quality. It's been huge for us for scaling. I don't know how anyone could do it without it, unless you're just selling hearing aid batteries or something. Not that that's wrong, in case there's someone who sells hearing aids listening batteries. But if you're selling like a high quality, custom, beautiful piece of something, man, good luck on on scaling up if you can't get your production.
Now, on that note, you guys, just perusing your website, immense selection of products, both with Saddleback and Love 41. And since you're more or less both the person or the company in charge of oversight of production, and you're on the retail end as well, is research and development for these additional products and different product lines different from perhaps just a business that's 100% wholesale, where they only have to worry about making the product and shipping it out?
No, the research and development part. So here's something cool we got going. I just make things that I like. So like the other day I came across one of our guys in Mexico. I mean, incredible guys. He made some leather dominoes. And I was like, oh my gosh, those are so cool. And so we had this little contest with scrap leather, and they were so cool. I thought, you know what? We are absolutely going into production with these. And even though, you know, we're not going to sell hardly any of those things, but they're really cool. And so I make things that I like. And my wife, she's, oh my gosh, I got the greatest wife. She's super amazing. Like 11 different women call her their best friend. And she happens to be super fashionable, and she can decorate real well. And so when she designs stuff, she just designs stuff that she likes. She's like, hey, we're missing this in the line. We don't really have a backpack. We have a bag that converts to a backpack. But so then she'll design a backpack. And then we'll clear some lower sellers out, and we'll add new ones in. And we both do that. We just make things we like. And then all we have to do is find people who have our same tastes. And here's what's cool about that. People go, these guys are just cool. Like, they make things they like. It's like they love this. And we do. We love what we do. And so when someone gets a set of leather dominoes and they go, oh my gosh, this is so cool, and they smile, that's art to me. I created something that made someone smile. And I think that's art. Or, well, actually, Candido made made it, but we put it out there. We just enjoy what we do, and we make things that we like, and it brings about a good amount of people to get excited about us.
Definitely a different and almost refreshing approach to it. When you talk to other e-commerce companies, they're talking about focus groups and beta testing products, and it seems a little bit more simplified and potentially better, I would say, at Saddleback. Quickly, before we let you go and get back to your busy schedule, what does the future hold for Saddleback Leather, Love 41, or even you and Suzette as a whole? What things do you have in the pipeline?
So we do want to open a store. We've had so many people say, oh, if I could just feel it, I would fly in to wherever you are just to feel it and decide which one I want. And so we do want to open a store, a brick and mortar, which is kind of the opposite of what other people are doing. But we want to make it into like a major destination. So it'll be pretty big deal when we do. We had talked about it earlier here in Fort Worth, and some people on one of the pages on Facebook said that they were going to fill this hotel. They were going to make all the reservations for this, to fill this entire Hyatt for the grand opening for our store. So we thought, oh, that'd be fun. But one of the big emphasis we're doing is we're going to grow our factory. You know, we manufacture for other people also, but we really want to grow that factory. We have a daycare at our factory. And we have that, you know, that school I taught at way back when I had my first bag made. I said, hey, if we fund it, will you guys open a school by our factory? And they said, yeah, absolutely. So they've opened a factory, an English school for the kids of the employees. And we have a daycare. The kids are learning English, little toddlers and whatnot. And so we're pouring into our people, but we want to influence other factories and other businesses in Mexico to think about their people differently. And there are some real good ones, but there are some real bad ones. And so we want to put some pressure on the factory world down in Mexico, and we want to influence them. So we do that by having a very strong presence there. So that's what we're after, is growing that manufacturing. And if Saddleback grows, that's cool. If it doesn't, if it stays the same, that's cool. But we really want to grow that factory. That's where we're headed.
All right, Dave Munson, CEO and founder of Saddleback Leather Company. Thank you so much for joining us today on the Retail Focus Podcast.
Hey, thanks for having me. This is good. Thanks.
Today, Saddleback Leather continues to have an ever-growing following, and they're still showing visitors to their website how to create a knockoff of their bag, if so inclined. Finally, not all retail visionaries are creating new things. Back in July of 2016, we talked to a grocery industry veteran in Ron Rhodes. Rhodes owns and operates two independent grocery stores, and he's not reinventing the wheel per se, but rather he's finding new ways to interact with and serve his customers in small markets. He discusses the various ways in which his small company is embracing digital to attempt to keep up with the grocery giants.
We'll start by first thanking you for taking the time out of your busy schedule to join us. How did you get started in the grocery business?
I actually graduated from college, was in the Army, went through ROTC. After my active duty, my wife's father had a small neighborhood store, and I worked in that while I was going to interview and look for my career, and I just really enjoyed working in the grocery store, visiting with customers every day, and just kind of the laid back part of visiting with people and working and challenging to sell more every day, and that's how I got started.
So how did you get then advanced to where now you're owning and operating your own stores?
After working for him for a couple of years, my wife and I purchased our first store, a very small neighborhood store, and then in time grew to a larger store and then added other stores, and we have four stores now.
We talked before the interview and as we were scheduling the interview about all the changes that you've seen in the grocery industry since you got into it 40 years ago. And you started out with this small neighborhood store, and now a lot of your stores have a number of other facets to them, whether it be in-store sushi or online ordering, that type of thing. What are some of the biggest changes you feel like you've seen over 40 years?
You know, there's been a dramatic number of changes. I think probably starting with the customer aspect, the way customers pay for groceries today is significantly different. It's primarily debit cards and credit cards versus when we went in business, it was personal checks and cash. So there's been a transition to plastic that has impacted a lot. I think the other thing that we see today is the variety of products that are available to us that we did not have 40 years ago. We have so many things that nobody heard of then or had not been developed. That and also the fact that so much of our fresh fruits and vegetables have such a longer span to where we have them several more weeks or even around the year, where before it was very limited access to some of those. So difference in the products and difference in the way people pay.
Now, you mentioned specifically the way people pay and the way that's transitioned. What challenges or difficulties has that presented your business as you've continued to grow?
You know, I think that when we look at cash flow, it's 2 or 3 days before we collect credit and debit card transactions, where before, when it was cash or checks, went to the bank the next day. So we lost a little bit of cash flow there. But I think the advantage has been the fact that we are receiving less insufficient checks. That part of the cost of the business has gone down. Certainly the cost of processing plastic transactions has gone up. So, and I think it probably has sped up our check stand somewhat. Usually people can swipe their plastic quicker than they write out a check. So we see customer throughput as being quicker.
As an independent grocery store owner, you've got four stores. A lot of the larger chains, you know, Kroger's got well over 1,000 outlets. You go to your larger chains and most of them have at least 200 stores. What are some of the advantages of having four stores and a more manageable footprint that you feel you might have over some of the larger companies?
I think that we probably can react better to the local community. I think that we can probably be more familiar with the events and the things that's happening in our community than perhaps a big chain might be. I think that we feel more like a neighbor to our customers. They know us personally, we know them, we know their kids, their grandkids. So I think there's a connectiveness there that we enjoy as a smaller store. The other thing I think that it gives us an opportunity to be a little more flexible with our promotions and our advertising. Now, if we got a great buy today on bananas, we can put those in the newspaper tomorrow. We don't have to wait on anybody to make a decision to approve an advertising budget or a change. So I think there's some things like that that we can react to pretty quick. And we use quite a bit of direct mail with a reward card. We look at people's purchases with a reward card, and we recognize their spending patterns, and we do direct mail to reward them for that. And, you know, I think that just being drilling down on the local community is an advantage.
You mentioned the reward card, and I know about a decade ago that was emerging technology. You started to see a lot of stores and chains start to adopt that. What was your thought process at Rhodes Grocery regarding adoption of that rewards card, and how did that enable you to interact with customers?
We really wanted to know who our best customers were. You know, perhaps our best customer comes in at 9 o'clock at night and I'm not at work, and I need to know that. We also needed to know what their purchasing was and what they were interested in buying. From the reward card, we've set up some programs that we think are very good. For example, we track all of their purchases for pet food, dog food, cat food, and those goods. When they've reached $50 in purchases in our store, then our cash register prints out a $5 coupon for their next purchase. We have cereal clubs where we track their purchases. When they reach a certain amount, we print a coupon good for any purchase of any type of cereal on their next purchase. So we've kind of looked at some of those categories where people are buying, and we've been able to reach out and reward those with savings on their next purchase. The other thing that we do, we look at probably the top 750 customers who spend the most with us. For example, the 1st of November, they will get a thank you card. Thank you card entitles them to a free 10 to 12 pound turkey for their Thanksgiving basket. So we do look at spending patterns, and top shoppers, we do provide some free goods and stuff like that around the holiday.
It's an amazing way to drive customer engagement, certainly giving away a Thanksgiving turkey of that size. One of the other things that you mentioned when you talked about flexibility was simply talking about your ability to adjust and change in terms of advertising. Has that also provided you some flexibility in terms of goods and product acquisition? Because now we see such a big push in larger and smaller grocers towards local and sustainable.
Yes. You know, we really, one of the things we want to concentrate on, and I think that perhaps in the grocery industry, we do a better job today as an industry in general with food safety. I think there's been a lot of things that's happened that's good. Dating of products, labeling of products, freshness guarantees. And I think that having the ability to look at that, try to bring in organic, gluten-free products our customers are asking are very easy. Anytime a customer comes in and says, you know, I bought this in this market when I was on vacation, can you get that? We certainly try to, and we make a real effort to do that. We try to get their name and phone number and give them a call when it comes in. And in addition to that, buying local from local farm co-ops has been an advantage on a fresh product, quicker to the store. And so there's a lot of avenues like that that we're approaching that I think are very good and enhancements in what we were able to do in the past.
Ron Rhodes, our guest on Retail Focus today. He is the owner of Rhodes Grocery Incorporated, an independent grocer that operates four stores. We've talked about some of the advantages of being an independent grocer. Now, on the flip side of that, what are some disadvantages where you feel like you might be swimming upstream at times against maybe some of the larger chains or competitors?
Well, I think that some people look at some competitors and think, well, you know, their prices are the cheapest, or I can save money there, when in fact they really don't look at their total order when they come in and compare prices. And I think that's always a thing to try to make sure that we're price competitive in what we do, and that's a challenge. On the other hand, though, I think that we have a lot of advantages as an independent when competing with large chains. You know, we have to develop strong partnerships with our suppliers, and I think that we've done a good job with that. We have to have a strong partnership with our banking community. We have to have a strong partnership with many of our vendors that provide us not goods but services such as insurance and some of those things. And I think that as an independent, you can develop those relationships. I know that you really have a heart in it and you really want to do good. And I think that while we have to be challenged with the Krogers and the Walmarts and those people of the world. I think that we can do that as long as we build those strong business relationships of people that provide us services and goods and work together with them closely.
You happen to be in a couple of different markets where you do have competition from some of the larger stores, and you've talked already about ways in which you can set yourself apart from those other stores in terms of the connectivity and the flexibility. What are some other ways that your stores have attempted to set themselves apart from those larger chains in those particular markets?
I think that we've really been very fortunate with our staff. We put a lot of effort into working with our staff, providing training. In this store, we've got a handful of employees that's been here over 30 years. We've got several that's been over 20 years. We really try to look at limiting turnover. When you come in, you're going to see the same people waiting on you in the deli or the bakery or the meat department, the same checkers. Now, we do hire a lot of college kids that work throughout the shift, but our predominant core, we work very hard maintain a consistent, competent staff. And I think customers feel comfortable when they go in the store and they see the same folks. So I think customer service, customer recognition, employee recognition has been a key. And we're very fortunate we have some very nice employees here.
Employee retention, certainly one of the biggest issues in any industry, but certainly the retail industry, you see that come up certainly an awful lot. You know, when I was walking into this particular store today, I noticed the click and shop program, and I've seen technology is very much a part of what you guys are trying to do now. What are some ways in which you're using some of the newer forms of technology? Omnichannel is such a big term now. What are some ways in which you guys are attempting to use that to, again, try to differentiate yourself?
Well, we have one person on staff that's in charge of Facebook, in charge of our website, and in charge of texting. And we do text blasts, special events, special meals, special offers we have throughout the week to for anybody that signs up for texting. And we've got into web-based ordering. We did our first order in January, and you can go online to our website. You can order any one of the thousands of products that we have in the store, including bakery items, fresh meat, fresh produce. Click and send the order to us. And with our website, if you predominantly buy the same thing, you can save your order and reorder. If you have a favorite recipe that has a segment or eight the ingredients in it, you can save that recipe and just click on it, and you've ordered all of those at once. We have some daycare organizations that take care of several children, and they are consistent orders every week that they file or send in on the web, and it saves them from leaving their daycare to go out and shop. While web-based grocery ordering is not for everyone, it certainly has a place, and I think it will be a growing business, and we've seen growth in it in the 6 months we've been doing it. We're very pleased with it.
We've talked a little bit about where the grocery industry has been over the last 40 years, and now we're talking about this newer technology. Where do you see, as an independent grocer, where do you see the industry heading over the next decade or two decades?
I think that we're going to continue to be challenged to be more responsive to the customer, the customer's specific desires. I think that we're going to continue to strive to provide safe, clean food environments for people to shop from. And I think that we're in a little bit of a process right now where people are backing away from processed food and going more to natural foods and healthier foods. I think some of the things that's helped us are the food channels, the food shows. People see that, see how to cook. They get excited about creating a meal. And I think that the healthy portion will have a big impact. I think the other thing that's going to happen is that we're going to continue to be challenged with restaurants and other food providers or meal providers and how we compete with a restaurant and how people view their mix of where they eat or whether they eat at home. And I think those will be challenges.
Ron Rhodes, 40-year grocery industry veteran and owner of Rhodes Grocery Incorporated. Thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you very much.
As always, we may have a position in or against companies we discuss on the podcast. Do not invest in stocks solely on the input of the podcast hosts.
To Today, Rhodes' stores have expanded to include coffee shops and baked potato bars. They're still going strong in the face of continued competition from the likes of Walmart and Kroger. Well, that'll do it for this edition of the Retail Focus podcast. We thank you for listening, and we'll be back next week with a fresh slew of news and notes from the world of retail. We hope everyone had a good July 4th week, and we'll see you 7 days from now.
This has been the Retail Focus Podcast. For more, visit our website at retailfocuspodcast.com and subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. Follow us on Twitter at Retail Podcast.